The setting is Miami, Florida. The games of the 2020 Woke Olympiad. Night one of the opening ceremony. Oh, what a night it was, ladies and gentlemen. The Woke Olympics are so big they need two opening nights. Today, just part one. In Woke it was. Oh my God, what a joke. All right, welcome to the program, ladies. Any chance I get to play the Olympic theme song, it's a good pick-me-up, even if it's in a mocking way. I do think I've discovered why Saturday Night Live doesn't parody liberals anymore. It's not just liberal bias, although it is liberal bias. It's also the fact that these people are beyond parody. You can't parody. They are the parody. How do you parody them? How would you write a parody of a Weird Al Yankovic song? You can't do it. It's already been done. Well, that is what we saw on stage in Miami on night one. It was something to behold. Welcome to the program. I'm Derek Hunter, by the way. Thank you for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. Thanks for rating and reviewing on iTunes and sharing on social media and all of that and all your emails. Oh, man. You can email me, Derek@dailycaller.com. A lot of you did during the debate. And holy cow, what a mess. What an absolute mess. Programming note on tomorrow's show, the Friday edition, we'll of course, break down day two of the Woke Olympic opening ceremony. That one promises to be much more interesting. It won't be as many also-rans. But we'll also have an interview. The interview this week will be with Chris Scalia. Christopher Scalia is the son of the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. He has just put out a book about his father and his father's faith. We talked about his the new book, the past book about his father's life. And just as it's a very cool conversation. It's a look behind the curtain or under the robe, if you're into that analogy, of one of the, if not the greatest Supreme Court justices this country has ever had. You'll come away knowing Justice Scalia better than you did before, even if you knew him well. And if you didn't know him at all, it'll be a great surprise. So we'll also, he drew the winners for the Shannon Bream books. Who they are, I can't remember off the top of my head because I have a horrible memory for that sort of thing. But you'll hear your name on the show on Friday, and then you just email me your address, and eventually I will send you, when I get a chance, to get out from underneath diapers and cat poop. Yeah, there's a lot of cat poop here, too. I will mail it off to you. I just mailed out the Brent Bozell books, so if you're one of the winners of those, you'll be getting it next week sometime. I just didn't have a chance to get to the post office until today. Okay, let's get on with it. Oh my God. I feel poorer for having watched it. Not in my soul, although that too, but in my wallet. These people are promising the sun, the moon, and the stars to everybody and everything. They also really look at this country as an awful place. I'm not sure why they want to lead it. If I looked at the United States, if I looked at any country that I lived in, the way that Democrats look at the United States and talk about the United States, I'd leave it. I'd flee it. Imagine if your husband or wife talked about you this way or talked about your marriage. Well, I love Earl, but he's a racist, sexist, homophobe, hates women, total misogynist, abuses me by making sure that I make significantly less than he does. Is always invading other people. It's just threatening everybody, violent, nasty, wouldn't you sit there and listen to your friend talk about their spouse and you go, well, what in the hell are you doing with them? Why would you stay with them? You have to wonder what, well, don't worry, he'll change. If your friend told you that about an abusive spouse who was a horrible, everything you can possibly throw at them in a pejorative sense, and they, you say, why would you stay with them? And they said, well, I think I can change them. You'd think they were crazy. You might not want to be their friend after that. Yet that is the Democratic Party's plan for this country. It's a horrible place. It's god-awful. But I can change it. Sure you can. Of course, it's weird to say that at a time when most people think that the economy is doing pretty well. You'd never know that from the debate. Near record low unemployment. It's been like 1969 was the last time we had an unemployment rate this low. And real wages have gone up significantly for the first time in more than a decade. And they're sitting there talking about how awful this country is. I don't know why you wouldn't stand at the southern border and play a game of Red Rover with your hands glued together, telling these illegal aliens, don't come here. Don't try to swim the Rio Grande, especially with your child, moron. Go back home. This is a horrible country. If you come in here, you're just going to face oppression. That's the view they have. That's the view that was on stage. That was the view that was on display. I hope it wasn't lost on the audience, but other than that, it was kind of fun. I have a lot of audio to get to, and it's tough to know where to start. We'll start with Spanish, I guess, just because. It's kind of funny. It was the side eye heard round the world, Cory Booker, New Jersey senator, when Beto O'Rourke started talking in Spanish. Cory Booker, there's video of it. You have to find it. It needs to be set to the Curb Your Enthusiasm music of Cory Booker looking shocked and giving a side eye like, oh, crap. Now, Cory Booker kind of speaks a little Spanish, too. I don't speak any Spanish. I have no idea if these people are fluent in Spanish or not. I do know that if they had said something wrong, like remember when Hillary went to Russia with the reset button and the foreign minister said this actually says overcharge. I don't know if they were speaking fluent Spanish or broken Spanish or stupid Spanish or whatever. I do know that this country, to be a citizen of this country, we have been told by these politicians who are promising asylum to all illegal aliens, Republicans and Democrats, that they say, they swear to us, they've pledged to us that to become a U.S. citizen, part of the requirements currently and even under their mass amnesty plans will be that people need to learn English to become citizens. That's in the law. Yet, for some weird reason, these people think that speaking in Spanish to people who are only supposed to be citizens voting, therefore only supposed to be able to speak, well, not only be able to speak English, but to be able to speak English in order to become a citizen. They thought it was worth their time to speak in Spanish. And the liberals thought this was very woke. It was very exciting. They were very MSNBC was aroused at the speaking of Spanish. The debate was co-hosted by Telemundo, which is also owned by NBC News, which again, Spanish, it pisses me off that I have to have those included in my cable. I don't speak it. I don't want to subsidize it. I don't want to pay for it. But, you know, NBC requires that if you want NBC, if you want their channels, you've got to take all these other channels that people don't want or watch. But we have a little montage here of the Democrats speaking Spanish. And at the end, Julian Castro, who back in 2016 was considered one of the front runners to be Hillary Clinton's running mate, but was passed over for... God, can you believe Tim Kaine. Tim Kaine, Virginia's other senator with worse hair. Julian Castro was passed over for Tim Kaine because Tim Kaine spoke Spanish, and while Julian Castro was Hispanic, still is, last I checked, he didn't speak Spanish at the time. So he ran out and he was trying to cram and learn Spanish or become more fluent in Spanish. Maybe he spoke a little, but he didn't speak enough Spanish. He ran out and tried to learn enough Spanish to be qualified to be Hillary Clinton's running mate. The guy is Hispanic, Julian Castro. Hillary Clinton said, sorry, you're not Spanish enough because you can't pander in another language. I'll take the white guy who can speak the language. Well, Julian Castro has finished his correspondence course at Online Pander University and has learned Spanish. And at the end, he takes a dig at Donald Trump. He does so in English. It's just a little bit. Don't worry. There's not a whole lot of Spanish here. It's a pretty quick clip.
This economy has got to work for everyone. And right now we know that it isn't. And it's going to take all of us coming together to make sure that it does. Necesitamos incluir cada persona en el éxito de esta economía. Pero si queremos hacer eso, necesitamos incluir cada persona en nuestra democracia. Cada votante necesitamos la representación y cada voz necesitamos escuchar.
La situación ahora es inaceptable. Este presidente ha atacado, ha demonizado los inmigrantes. Es inaceptable y voy a cambiar este.
Vamos a tratar cada persona con el respeto y dignidad que merecen como humanos.
Me llamo Julián Castro y estoy postulando por presidente de los Estados Unidos. The very fact that I can say that tonight shows the progress that we have made in this country. On January 20th, 2021, we'll say adios to Donald Trump.
The very fact that I can pander to you in two languages today shows the progress that we have made. What progress have we made, Julian? What progress have we made that allows you to say that in Spanish? And what was stopping you from saying it, or stopping anybody from saying it in Spanish before? How is this now progress? Because I remember George W. Bush campaigning in Spanish. He was actually fluent in Spanish, probably still is, yet the media didn't line up to sniff his throne when he was done doing so. They didn't look at it as, oh my God, it's so progressive. And it still begs the question, why do you need to, if a requirement for citizenship is learning English? Maybe, just maybe, these people are lying to us. From there, oh, geez, where did they go? They went everywhere. It was weird. Oh, one thing I did learn about Spanish speakers is that when Cory Booker speaks Spanish, he looks like a bad dubbed movie. Watch the video of it. It's very weird. His mouth seems to do things that don't correspond with what's coming out of it. He just looks like, you know, like an old kung fu movie. It's very bizarre. One of the, of course, immigration, I guess I should say it properly, immigration was one of the hot topics that were debated last night, and it was set off perfectly timed by the horrible photograph of the father and his 22-month-old daughter who had drowned trying to swim the Rio Grande. They blamed Donald Trump for that. He set the tone. How somebody's inability to swim and their sheer stupidity of trying to swim the Rio Grande with an infant while not being a strong swimmer is the fault of the president. And if you look at that picture, and I know everybody, the politically correct thing to say is what everybody's saying. Tragic, tragedy, tragic photo, so on and so forth. I looked at the picture and I was, it's sad. It's definitely sad. But it looks to me like the guy stuck the kid in his shirt as if that was going to be a way to carry the kid across a raging river. That's incredibly stupid. The story that we're told is that he came to the border and was turned back by the mean policies of the Trump administration. He came to the border trying to seek asylum, because they are all trained to try to seek asylum. And Castro actually blamed Donald Trump for these deaths. NBC fact-checked that. We'll have that in a second. But they came to the border and were turned back because Trump policy is, if you're going to seek asylum, you have to wait in Mexico. Okay, so if you have a legitimate asylum claim, why wouldn't you then be content with that? The Mexican government is offering shelter. The Mexican government is offering care. You will be not starving to death if you wait in Mexico. Yet this guy decided he didn't want to wait or didn't have to wait. And that's likely because of all the hoopla from the Democrats encouraging people not to wait. So if you really want to get technical, the death of these two people is firmly in the hands of the left. But ultimately, realistically, and this is, again, wildly politically incorrect and unpopular, the deaths of the father and child lie firmly in the hands of the father. The father was irresponsible. Lord knows how long he marched his child, and he brought his child likely because Democrats have set up this system where that's the golden ticket, man. You bring a kid with you to the border and you say asylum, you just get right in. Go ahead. Welcome to the United States of America. But sickeningly, these Democrats want to blame Donald Trump for bad decisions by other people, as if part of being president of the United States is teaching people in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua how to swim, or sending them flotation devices for when they get to the southern border and refuse to adhere to the rules to entering the country and decide to just go across a raging river. We're supposed to maybe build a rope bridge for them, but somebody will fall off of that, so we'll probably have to go straight up with a path bridge or a footpath bridge or some sort of flotation device. And hell, we're really only a couple of years away from Democrats advocating that we send charter planes down to these countries to pick up the illegal immigrants, to bring them to the country. If they ever get power, I wouldn't be surprised. You know what? The 2,000-mile march is a hardship that these people, these sweet, sweet, nourishing migrants shouldn't have to face. Therefore, we shall send down the Air Force. Cargo planes. No. We'll get 767s. Hell, use Air Force One, too, and get down there to bring these people up here. It's the humane thing to do. And while we're at it, let's just not do these three crap countries in Central America. Let's go all around the world. We'll call them freedom flights, and we'll welcome migrants into this country, and we'll grant them citizenship and register them to vote. They won't have to learn a language. They'll just become a loyal Democratic Party base, voting base, and then we'll put them in little ghettos, little ethnic ghettos, where they can recreate the hellholes that they just fled, because assimilation is racism. Assimilation is genocide. I'm only partially joking about this. This is how the Democrats feel. The only part that I'm joking about is the fact that there would be flights. They haven't offered that yet. But listen to this NBC News fact check. One thing I learned yesterday from the debate and after the debate was that NBC News has a streaming service. I honestly had no idea. And I don't think anybody else has any idea either. But listen to this fact checker check Julian Castro's assertion that the death of those two migrants is the fault of Donald Trump. Shockingly enough, they fact check it true.
You know, we had a pretty clean debate, Morgan. I've been doing this for a while. I'm here in this NBC workspace, and we were typing away, checking every claim, every number that came across our desks. It was a pretty clean debate. A few things I wanted to bring up. We saw Julian Castro tie the tragic death of that father and daughter to Trump's own immigration policies. And we checked that. It is true that the president has instituted with his administration policies that slow the number of asylum seekers that can enter the country each day and claim asylum. And this was something that, according to the reporting in Mexico, is one of the things that motivated this father to risk his life and cross the Rio Grande when he was tragically killed.
There you have it. A major news organization agreeing with Julian Castro that Donald Trump has blood on his hands for enforcing American immigration law. It's one of the factors that caused his father to decide to swim across the Rio Grande and drowned. And be killed. He drowned. He died. He wasn't killed. Killing requires somebody else or something else to do it. This guy's bad decision caused his and his daughter's death. Tragic? Yes. Killed? No. Donald Trump's fault? Absolutely not. He marched up here with every intention of violating our laws, and then was told, we'll let you violate our laws. All you got to do is just wait here for a while we process a whole bunch of people through. You've got to wait your turn, the way you should have done it back in your home country. And he said, nope, that's not good enough for me. I see other people breaking the law again, double breaking the law, just entering the country. And once you get over there, then you can just say the same things because our laws are so stupid and screwed up that he decided to take a swim for it. And he decided to do so without bothering to spring for an inner tube, so much as a garbage bag that he blew up and tied a knot in. How this series of dumb decisions is the fault of anyone other than the person who made them is beyond me. Nobody in the mainstream media wants to say that. You just got to say, well, it's a horrible tragedy, and look down and kick some dirt and sway from side to side about how sad it is. And it's sad, but it's his own damn fault. If Democrats would start discouraging people from abusing their children by putting them on this baton death march, because they tell them that once they get here, they'll be welcome and they'll be a goodie bag like they're a presenter at the Oscars and come on in, then these people would not be making this march. If liberal activists were not down there coaching them, here's the magic phrase you have to say to be able to stay in this country as long as you have a kid with you, then these people wouldn't be dying. By the way, this, of course, is getting a ton of media coverage. It was on the front page of the New York Times story. And this is very interesting. It's a horrible photograph. I mean, they're laying dead face down in the water. They happen to be on the Mexico side, but there's a lot of different pictures from a bunch of different angles. I'm old-fashioned. If I see somebody in that situation, I try to help them. I don't take pictures of them. And, you know, that's just me. But this is getting a lot of play because it is ready-made emotional pap designed not to make people think, but to make people feel. Yet Breitbart reports, and this, their headline says it all. They didn't. It's weird what matters now and what didn't matter then. The headline at Breitbart, 20 times Breitbart reported on migrant deaths during Obama-Biden years and no one cared. Yes, believe it or not, people have been dying trying to sneak into this country since before we were a country. The Rio Grande, you can walk across it in some places. In other places, it's a damn raging river. Where there isn't the Rio Grande, there are large stretches of desert. Guess what happens in a desert? There's not a lot of water out there. You can die of dehydration and starvation because there's not a lot of people living there as well. You have to make a conscious decision to do these things. These people did it. Yet the 20 people that died, or at a minimum 20 people, these are just the people that Breitbart reported on, didn't make national news. Because Barack Obama was president. Why would it? It's no big deal. Nothing Barack Obama did. When Barack Obama was telling people not to send their children up unaccompanied and into this country illegally because they'll be sent back, there was no national outcry. Occasionally there'd be stories, and this always cracked me up. Barack Obama is the deporter in chief, some of the more radical elements would say, and even some of the more sane-ish elements in the Democratic Party, elected officials would say, more people, deportations skyrocketed under Barack Obama. Deportations did not skyrocket under Barack Obama. What they counted as a deportation changed. And it goes back to my theory is if you control the unit of measure, you control everything. For the first time in American history, the Obama administration counted people being turned back at the border as deportations. You walk up and you say, I want to enter. And they say, no, you've got to go back. And they turn around and go back, mostly Mexican citizens, because they can be turned back and immediately deported. It's weird. Mexican citizens, you can deport immediately. Other countries, we have to have a hearing. They must have due process. We should treat all countries the same way. But they counted people being turned back at the border as being deported, which is, of course, not how deportations work. But that allowed them to pad the numbers to be able to say, well, we are deporting more people than ever before. I don't know what the problem is. Barack Obama is the deporter in chief. And nobody in the media questioned it, just like the jobs saved or created. They couldn't create enough jobs for it to matter, for it to really register. So they said, well, we're saving jobs as well. And we're just going to roll them into one monthly number and claim credit for all of them. Your job was probably saved countless times by the Obama administration, and you didn't even know it. And you didn't send a thank you card because of it. So nice job, jerks. But I love this because the people at Grabian, which is a sort of a clearinghouse for audio clips, they put together a little montage of Democrats, of journalists, but I'm being redundant there, telling us, swearing to us for the past few months. And this is just a small slice of the example, but I want to play it because it fits into this discussion about the border. Telling us that this is a fake crisis, it's a manufactured crisis, there is no crisis on the southern border. Yet suddenly, once they found that it was no longer something that they could deny, once it reached critical mass, they wanted to attack Trump about the no toothbrushes and the no beds. They said, well, this is a crisis. This is now a crisis. But for months, they swore to us that there is no crisis. Don't take my word for it. Listen to them in their own words.
Here's my question. Are you convinced? Did this last-ditch effort to persuade Americans that there is a crisis at the southern border, did it work?
This is a manufactured crisis. At the heart of this whole thing are a whole bunch of lies.
We have a president who will go on TV tonight and lie and lie and lie some more. This is a manufactured crisis.
Wouldn't we be there because it was a crisis? They were being overrun.
Yeah.
You know, there's something manufactured about this.
Yeah. There's no crisis. It's a manufactured crisis.
This is a manufactured crisis.
He's taking 800,000 federal employees hostage so he can get his vaccine. So he's created this crisis. It's a manufactured crisis.
This whole mess is manufactured. It's a manufactured crisis, a non-crisis at the border that's really not fooling anybody.
All the elected officials, including Republican colleagues, all state that this is a manufactured crisis and a crisis that manufactured by the Trump administration.
This whole thing is absurd. It is a completely manufactured, you know, appeal to the ugliest sentiments. And then, frankly, you know, I wonder about our complicity in just talking about this.
It's complete and utter nonsense trying to solve a problem that, in fact, doesn't exist because there's zero net illegal immigration coming across the southern border.
He's determined to convince you there is a crisis at the border. They're playing the public, you, for suckers.
You suckers out there, don't you? No, now it's this border crisis. We must address this border crisis. This crisis is of Donald Trump's own making. How is that? How is the guy who has been warning people about the crisis at the southern border to blame when the people who denied that there was a crisis at the southern border suddenly realized there's a crisis at the southern border? Actually, they didn't suddenly realize it. They suddenly found it politically advantageous. They found a way to spin it. Oh, there's no toothbrushes down there. Oh, no, that's the same thing as pulling out fingernails from people. It's the same damn thing. And I love the one, like, there are children down there without enough diapers. Well, where are their parents? Did they not bring a supply of diapers? Or are they sending diapered infants on their own up to our southern border? It's our responsibility. Everything is our fault or our responsibility to the left. Well, we need to provide these children with diapers. If we had released these people into the United States, who would take care of these children's diapers? If we had released these people into the United States, would their parents then give them toothbrushes? Did they come to the United States just for a trip to Walgreens? You know, I hear that they're having a sale on Crest. So we marched 2,000 miles for the hell of it to see if we could get a travel size thing of Crest and a small toothbrush, a disposable toothbrush. Or maybe, is there something else at work here? I think maybe there's something else at work here. As for the rest of the debate, everybody wants socialized medicine, different forms of it. That wasn't really surprising. There were attacks on the health, on the prescription drug industry. They're the boogeyman this time. And again, they're occasionally the boogeyman. I loved when they're saying, well, we need to put these executives in prison for the opioid crisis. Maybe. But how about you let them get convicted of something first? I mean, that's a crazy idea that people are taking prescription drugs and become addicted, painkillers and become addicted is sad. But you got to prove that it's the fault of the pharmaceutical company. I know they're making a case against the people who made OxyContin, and maybe they'll win that case. Who knows? But until it's proven, we're supposed to have the presumption of innocence. if every illegal alien is supposed to be assumed to be the salt of the earth, then maybe we could afford American citizens a little bit of due process first. I mean, again, I'm speaking out of school, and I apologize for bringing logic to this debate, but let's just think about it that way for a second, shall we? The idea, first, if you, my mother, when she was alive, had chronic pain. When I was a kid, when I was 9 years old, she had her right leg amputated above the knee. She had arteriosclerosis. There was no circulation. Gangrene was setting in. She also had an artificial artery put in from her shoulder to her hip on the other side. She had horrible phantom pains, bouts of it. It would come and go. There were all sorts of other health problems. That she lived as long as she did was a blessing and a miracle of modern medicine. But she had pain pills. She took them as needed, sparingly. She didn't take them every day. She took them only when she was in pain. If used properly, pain medicine is incredibly important. It's a godsend to people who suffer chronic pain. To listen to these Democrats pander to an audience, in the name of the opioid crisis, we must basically do away with pain pills. One of them was bitching about how, well, these drug companies have monopolies on their medicines. Yeah, because they invented them. They created them. That's kind of how it works. They only have, I think, like 7 years until the patent goes off, and then all the generic companies can manufacture them. So they got to spend over $1 billion to develop this drug, bring it to market, and then recoup enough money to be able to do more research and development and pay their employees, you know, crazy things like that, and, you know, God forbid, turn a profit in the process. And Democrats want to end that. They want to demonize that. If you do that, you can do that. The government can step in and ruin the industry. Then you'd better hope that if you come down with something, and odds are you or somebody you love will come down with something, you'd better hope that there's already a treatment for it or a lot of people get it. Because if it's something that impacts a few hundred or a few thousand people a year, there is no financial incentive for any company to do research and development on it if the government is going to come in and set prices on it. Just throwing that out there, because the prescription drug debate, prescription drugs helped keep my mother alive for a very long time. And to see these people want to destroy the industry, you prove malfeasance, fine, go after them. But because somebody was overprescribed or prescribed pain medicine because they needed it and became addicted and then switched to heroin is not the fault of the pill manufacturer. It strikes me more as, I don't know, bad pain management and bad monitoring by the doctors. That's the way when my brother, he had some shoulder surgery a while back, not that long ago, a year ago maybe. And they gave him, I think, 60 OxyContin pills. 60 OxyContin pills. And he was told, take 3 a day. Now, you have your shoulder, I think he had his shoulder replaced. You have your shoulder replaced, it hurts. But you're better off being told not to take 3 OxyContins a day to keep the pain away. You're better off being told, look, it's going to hurt. Tolerate the pain as much as you can. Try taking some aspirin or some Advil. And if that doesn't work, if it really is too much to bear, then you take one of these and see how it does. Take these sparingly. Use these sparingly. Instead, they just, here's a giant bottle of them and go to town. Well, 60 of them is a hell of a lot of pills. He didn't take them, thank God. He disposed of them, gave them to the police or whatever. Or I don't even know if he filled the prescription, but I know he didn't take them. And that's good. There's a possibility that you can become addicted to these things. You have to be smart. You have to be responsible. I get the person with chronic back pain who takes the pills and then the doctor doesn't want to give them pills, or they're going around, they need more and more as they build up a tolerance, and then they turn to heroin or whatever. And I feel sympathy for those people, but I sure as hell don't want to destroy an incredible industry that makes people's lives better, despite the 90% of the commercials you see on television for things that, I don't know, everybody in pharmaceutical commercials seems to be having a blast. I don't understand what it is. Half the time, I don't even know what the ailment is, but they sure seem to be having fun with it. And like, why can't I get that? Because they've got, they're everywhere they are, they're smiling and having a lot of fun. But you don't want to destroy that industry that has done so much good for humanity because some people get addicted to their products. Some people abuse it. Drug dealers steal the pills and sell them and put them in ingredients and other things. It's insane the lengths to which we will go. Again, it goes back to the trying to absolve people of personal responsibility. Try and buy cold medicine, Dimetapp or something like that, without an ID. You can't, you know, you can vote just by walking into a polling place, and asking for an ID is a hate crime. But if you want to quell the sniffles and a cough, you need to be fingerprinted. You can only buy so much of it, and it's behind the counter. You have to show an ID. It's so screwed up. Everything is so screwed up in this country, and it's because the government says there's this very small problem that affects, you know, a small amount of people. Now, people, a lot of people do die from opioids. But again, they're not all coming at it from a bad doctor giving them prescriptions because of their ingrown toenail. People do choose to just go straight to heroin. Why we have to uproot the entirety of a thriving industry that it should be the pride of the world is beyond me, yet that is what these people want to do. Anyway, I've got a couple more clips from the debate. I didn't mean to go off on that rant, but as a former health policy analyst, it drives me nuts when I see morons who don't know anything about the industry, who have never studied it, but boy, they got an idea, and they know what plays well. Big company, bad. Drug companies charge too much for their pills. Maybe, but it's that or being sick or dying. So how much is that worth to you? Because they've got to recoup some money because they're working on other drugs right now. There's no drug company out there who says, you know what, screw research and development. We're just going to manufacture what we're comfortable with, what we've got. Because in 7 years, they'll be out of business. That's just how it works. They're doing something while these politicians are demonizing them. All right. Another part of the debate that was kind of funny. Julian, it really was a woke-off at different times. Cory Booker couldn't answer a question without mentioning his race or the race of his neighborhood. I'm the only candidate up here who lives in a majority black and brown neighborhood. Yeah, you're a poverty tourist, Cory. Congratulations. How many nights do you spend at home? Probably not all that many. You have rich friends. You grew up in a wealthy family. Both of your parents were executives at IBM. You went to elite schools throughout your whole life, and you decided, I'm going to go live with the common folk. I doubt you invite them into your home. Maybe your imaginary friend T-Bone. Seriously, Cory Booker had an imaginary friend as an adult. As mayor of Newark, he referenced his friend T-Bone and the lessons that he learned from T-Bone repeatedly until finally, some journalist said, hey, it would probably be really interesting to interview this T-Bone. Like, T-Bone had threatened his life at one point, Cory Booker said. So he tried to find T-Bone. And it turns out that Cory Booker had to admit that T-Bone didn't really exist. He was a fake character. He was made up. And you're like, what the hell? And he's still running for president. He was still elected to the United States Senate by the people of New Jersey. That's how screwed up some people in this country are. But I wasn't going to actually start about Cory Booker. I want to talk about Julian Castro, because a couple of you noticed this, and I noticed it at the time, too. You emailed me about Julian Castro talking about abortion. Boy, everybody up there just can't wait to get a hold of your paycheck to pay for abortions. I'm surprised. It won't be long before Democrats are offering subsidies to get women pregnant if they promise to have an abortion. They really seem to have a fetish for this to that point. Joseph Mengele is sitting in hell looking up going, you guys are going a little overboard on this thing, don't you think? Castro wanted to be super woke because in the abortion discussion, can't call it a debate because they all agreed that abortions anytime, every time, and for free should be the rule of the day. So Castro found a way to make himself the most woke, only he kind of screwed up which might get him, well, he gets points for being this woke and trying, so it won't really impact him. Listen to the clip and see if you can spot the wokeness.
Secretary Castro, this one is for you. All of you on stage support a woman's right to an abortion. You all support some version of a government health care option. Would your plan cover abortion, Mr. Secretary?
Yes, it would. I don't believe only in reproductive freedom. I believe in reproductive justice. And, you know, what that means is that just because a woman, or let's also not forget someone in the trans community, a trans female, is poor, doesn't mean they shouldn't have exercised that right to choose. And so I absolutely would cover the right to have an abortion.
I absolutely would cover the right to have an abortion. It's very important. We need to get more women pregnant so they can have more abortions, but not just women. We can't forget the trans community. We need trans women, of course, need abortions too, which would be a, if he were aware, if he were smart, and I'm not accusing him of being smart. He's never done anything that strikes me as being smart. It would be a ripping the needle off the record. Is that, can you even say that anymore? Does anybody know what a record is anymore? It would be the, what? Because everybody who's woke knows that a trans woman is a biological male who thinks they are a man. Or no, a woman. They think they are a woman. See, it's hard to keep track of. That means they have a penis, which, unless it's that horrible Arnold Schwarzenegger movie Junior, where he somehow got pregnant, never saw it, but then there aren't very many people with penises who are going to get pregnant. If he were super woke and genuinely woke, he would know that trans males are the ones who need abortions because they're actually women. It's just the party of science. You would think that they would know what they're talking about. Of course, they're just making this up as they go along. And he thought, hey, I can differentiate myself from the herd here by saying that I'm super woke and I support trans abortions too. These people. These freaking people. Speaking of these freaking people, let's go to Mayor Bill de Blasio. He did not get good reviews from the people at NBC. I'll play that for you after the clip you're about to hear. But listen to Bill de Blasio and think about the economic impact that what he's trying to sell here would do to this country. It would absolutely devastate the economy. But they want to pretend that the economy is in the toilet now because they want to get us used to the economy being in the toilet, because when they get back in power, down it will go.
Good evening. You're the mayor of the biggest city in the United States, but it's also one of the cities in the country with the greatest gap between the wealthy and the poor. How would you address income inequality?
Well, we've been addressing income inequality in New York City by raising wages, by raising benefits, by putting money back in the hands of working people. $15 minimum wage, paid sick days, pre-K for all, things that are making a huge difference in working people's lives. But let me tell you what we're hearing here already in the first round of questions is that battle for the heart and soul of our party. I want to make it clear. This is supposed to be the party of working people. Yes, we're supposed to be for 70% tax rate on the wealthy. Yes, we're supposed to be for free college, free public college for our young people. We're supposed to break up big corporations when they're not serving our democracy. This Democratic Party has to be strong and bold and progressive. And in New York, we've proven that we can do something very different. We can put money back in the hands of working people. And let me tell you, every time you talk about investing in people and their communities, you hear folks say there's not enough money. What I say to them every single time is there's plenty of money in this world. There's plenty of money in this country. It's just in the wrong hands. We Democrats have to fix that.
We have a perception problem with the Democratic Party. We are not connecting to the working class people in the very states that I represent, in Ohio, in the industrial Midwest. We've lost all connection. That we have got to change the center of gravity of the Democratic Party from being coastal and elitist and Ivy League, which is the perception, to somebody from the forgotten communities that have been left behind for the last 30 years, to get those workers back on our side.
Perception is reality, Congressman. Perception is reality. He's right. That's a huge problem for the Democratic Party. Unfortunately, the Democratic Party's electoral strategy seems to be to call everybody who's blue-collar dumb, call all white people racists, and that is a huge swath of the industrial Midwest. And so how do you appeal to people while you're using them as a cudgel to convince other people that their lives suck because of them, because of this other group of people? You can't do it. You can't really do it. The Democratic Party has forsaken the blue-collar, middle-class white voter. There's no way to appeal to them while because they need to demonize them to keep their coalition together. Oh, they're a bunch of homophobes. They're a bunch of uneducated rubes. They're morons. They voted for Trump. They want to appeal to the coastal elite. And they do. They do as they look down. The liberal elite, the closest they come to the Midwest is when their chemical toilet on their plane dumps out their waste on it. That's how they view it. They look down their nose, literally and figuratively, on people who didn't go to... You ever deal with anybody who ever went to Harvard or Yale? They're the most obnoxious people on the planet. And some of them can be good people, but they're tough to be around because they want you to know that they went to Harvard. And they will find a way to work it into every kind of conversation you can possibly have with them. The same thing with liberal elite. They just look down their nose. Everybody else is inferior. And in the Midwest, having grown up there, having lived my life there, people that live there don't like to be told what to do. They just want to be left alone. That's part of why Hillary Clinton's campaign failed so miserably. They were being promised all of these things. You're just going to have to rely on government for this, that, and the other thing. Proud people don't want to rely on government for things. Ultimately, they just want to be left alone. They don't care that somewhere there's a rich person having, sunbathing on a 100-foot yacht in the Caribbean. They don't really care. Yes, they'd like to be there. They'd like to be able to do that. But realistically, at the end of the day, what they really enjoy most is after a hard day's worth of a hard week's work, to have enough money to drink some beers, barbecue, hang out with their friends, shoot the shit, do all that sort of stuff. Have fun with their friends and family. And they understand they have to work hard to get it. They don't bask in the jealousy culture that the left seems to want to foment in society. So Tim Ryan gets it. But there's no way to pull up from that nosedive for the Democratic Party because their whole shtick now is the country sucks. It's an oppressive country. Only white people can be racist. Blue-collar people who voted for Trump are stupid. And don't worry, minorities, we'll take care of you. Well, look at Chicago. Look at Baltimore. Look at Washington, D.C. How is that working for you? Generational control and their killing zones. The media's reaction to this was kind of telling. I want to play a clip from MSNBC where they did not like Bill de Blasio at all. These are MSNBC hosts having a little bit of banter after the debate. They call him obnoxious. It's Claire McCaskill and Nicole Wallace. Claire McCaskill is a former senator from Missouri. She's now on the payroll of NBC News. And Nicole Wallace hosts some god-awful show in the middle of the day on MSNBC. She used to work for George W. Bush. Now she's a full-blown liberal. There are just a lot of... And she's always billed as a Republican. See, we're balanced. Look, we've got a Republican who has a show here. She's about as Republican as Shepard Smith is, but that's for another time. Listen to this exchange between these two about their thoughts in general about the debate, and then they get around to Bill de Blasio.
...of Donald Trump, so that surprised me a little. I thought the folks on the end did their best to elbow into every discussion they could, I found it mildly irritating at times.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just de Blasio is mildly irritating to
yeah.
me. I'm not sure, but or maybe even more than mildly irritating to me.
You seem pretty irritated.
So, like, I had the same reaction. I think that might break down along genital. He sounded to me like sort of an obnoxious guy at a restaurant or a bar talking really loudly on his cell phone, like everyone wants to hear what he's saying. Like I wanted to hear other people's answers, and he kept butting in.
Clearly his tactic, just to, you know, he was the first to butt in. And
not a good day for Bill de Blasio. Bill is obnoxious. God, I'd move away from him at a bar. I'd treat him like a fart in an elevator. There's something wrong with this guy. Mayor of New York, touting himself. He really was an obnoxious pile of garbage. Terry McAuliffe was the former governor of Virginia before Governor Blackface. He was also the former chairman of the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton's bag man back in the Clinton administration. Raised a ton of money. Total lib, obnoxious kind of guy. He's now, of course, a CNN contributor, because CNN is the refugee camp for all liberals who have nothing better to do. He was a little more blunt in his assessment about the entire debate. See, you get my assessment. I'm not going to like anything up there unless they all say, you know what, I finally read the Constitution while on the toilet today, and I realize that everything I've been advocating for is not only wrong, but destructive to the country, so I'm not going to run for president anymore. Then I might like what I saw on this stage. But to hear Democrats say it, I think, is much more powerful. This is the former chairman of the Democratic National Committee talking about what he saw on the debate stage. Not impressed.
I'm a little disappointed. I think we needed to have more discussion on those issues that actually affect Americans every single day.
Former chairman of the DNC. I wasn't impressed, man. It was a whole bunch of liberal pandering. He's a little bit concerned that the party is going so far left in this primary that there is no way conceivable for them to come back anywhere even in the vicinity of the middle for the general election. He realizes that super wokeness will win somebody the nomination, or it can win somebody the nomination, but it's an anchor when it comes to the general election. I love seeing that. It's a little scary, though, because that means that some of them are self-aware. I don't think they can do anything about it. Case in point, over on NBC, MSNBC, Donnie Douche, up late. Usually he'll probably be on Morning Joe as well. But Donnie Deutsch, who has made millions in advertising, he knows how to manipulate people, he knows how to appeal to people. It's how he's gotten rich. It's how he's gotten out of touch, is knowing how to manipulate people. He had a kind of similar assessment of the field. He does not think that anybody on that stage, and maybe with only the exception, possible exception of Joe Biden, but only the right Joe Biden, because you never know which Joe Biden's going to show up, can beat Donald Trump. He actually said this on MSNBC. The reaction to it is something to behold, but that'll be the next clip. Let's listen to Donnie Deutsch's assessment of the Democratic field.
My issue, unfortunately, and do not shoot the messenger, is the messenger. I do not believe Elizabeth Warren on stage with Donald Trump beats him. And I think if we're honest with ourselves and we look harder at ourselves, I think a lot of people agree with me. And I also think when you can label somebody a socialist, 57% of this country thinks that word is un-American. I'm not saying it's fair. When he can blanket Elizabeth Warren as a socialist and he's on stage with her, the Democrats lose. I think she's delightful. I think she's wonderful. I'm a big fan. I just don't think she has what it takes to beat this president the same way, at least an idealized version of Joe Biden is. Don't shoot the messenger. It's just facts. We got to get Trump out.
As an aside, I love how Donnie Deutsch says, don't shoot the messenger. You're not just the messenger, Donnie. You're the originator of the message. So maybe you should have that coming to you. That's not how that works. Don't shoot the messenger means that, hey, I'm just conveying information. It's not from me. You're actually conveying information from you. So They, of course, do circle the wagons. They love Elizabeth Warren. They were trying to tell you how Elizabeth Warren did so well in this debate. She didn't even speak the most. She was a non-entity in the second half of that debate. The first half of the debate, I thought she dominated. The second half of the debate, not so much. She was not there. Booker and O'Rourke had more speaking time. Cory Booker had the most speaking time with 10 minutes and 50 seconds. Dale Inslee, the Washington State governor, only got 4 minutes 59 seconds. They didn't really play all that fair. Congressman John Delaney, former Congressman John Delaney, he got 6 minutes flat. And he was trying to get answers. I love one time Rachel Maddow said, Congressman, we'll get to you right after this, but let somebody much more interesting speak. And then they never went to him. But after Donnie's little rant there, and I think true, I don't know that anybody in this field, certainly on a stage with Donald Trump, they'll look small. They'll look really small. Whether or not, you know, you think Donald Trump will look good, they'll look small next to him, not physically, but as people. Because they're just, I don't know, that they just don't have the it thing that attracts people. After hearing that, you'll hear the MSNBC Republican, Nicole Wallace, say, don't worry, this is a safe space, Donnie, because they all think alike. She's a liberal, too, but she's passed off as a conservative. And then Lawrence O'Donnell steps in and gets really rude. I've never met Lawrence O'Donnell, but I know people who've met Larry. And they say uniformly that he is just an incredibly arrogant douchebag. Just, I mean, Donnie Deutsch certainly isn't the most humble person you'll ever come across, but Lawrence O'Donnell is a douchebag. Everybody's seen that video. Stop the damn hammering! Yelling at staff. Apparently that's not uncommon when it comes to Larry. He says something incredibly rude about what Donnie Deutsch said, and when you've got two people with egos the size that these people have, there's going to be a little bit of a conflict. And Donnie Deutsch did not like being told that his opinion has zero value by the arrogant Larry O'Donnell. It's kind of a funny moment. Here it is.
Donnie, you're in a safe space here. You don't have to keep telling us that.
Well, let's just
can I just follow up on that though, Donnie? Yeah. Who could beat Trump? And did you see anyone on that stage tonight that could beat Trump?
I'm still sticking with an idealized version of no. Of the Joe Biden we want, okay? If Joe Biden we want, and then you pair him with the right candidate, yes. I still, in my heart of hearts, don't see anybody on that stage tonight that would beat Trump.
Let's just identify this for what it is.
And then we have Beto.
Pure guesswork a year and a half away from
absolutely.
The guess point.
Absolutely.
And so it has, and Donnie, I say this respectfully, zero value.
As I disagree. You know what? I disagree with that, Lawrence. It's understanding human behavior.
Me in a similar
don't tell
way
me it has zero value.
Zero value.
Don't tell me it has zero value. It's
it
understanding
does.
Human behavior.
It's a guess. And it's a wild guess, Donnie.
It's not. It's understanding human behavior. And no, I guarantee you, 90% of our audience
it's a wild
agrees
guess. There's no science in it. There's nothing
there's
in
no
it.
There's no science in any of this.
And no one can make it. You can put any name you want in the wild guess that you just made, and it doesn't make it true.
I'm understanding what Donald Trump, the way he connects with this country and the strength he exudes. We need to exude a stronger strength. It's
this
not
is,
a policy
this is the
discussion.
Pure guesswork section of the discussion.
This is a guy who's done this for 30 years and watched human behavior.
Now then.
And in comes Brian Williams, overpaid more than all of them. Oh, now then. It has zero value. Don't you love it when the claws come out on the left? Donnie Deutsch gave his opinion. You are really just a pile of vomit, Donnie. I mean this with all due respect, Donnie. I think you're a moron. But I mean that as a compliment. Take that in the nicest way you possibly can. God, I love it. I love it. And this is just night one of this circus. We've got a whole nother night of this tomorrow. They get to go back at it again, and they will. And tomorrow really is the main event. Tonight was the undercard. Elizabeth Warren should have just shined. She should have wiped the stage with those people, and she didn't. She became a non-entity. I thought she was well on her way in the first half of the debate, but then again, after NBC's technical problems with the audio, which was really horrible, she faded. She disappeared. She didn't exist. Was a non-entity. The winners, as far as winners, if I could turn off my brain and pretend to be a liberal for a second, I actually thought that, all the online polls have Tulsi Gabbard winning. She's a little bit nutty. But I thought that Castro had an okay night. I thought John Delaney, I'm not being a liberal when I say John Delaney was the most sane person on the stage, but he's not going anywhere. He's not going to get anything. From a liberal perspective, I think they'll like Bill de Blasio. I think he said the right things, and I think that he brought the right attitude. He's just a horrible person, and nobody likes him. We'll see tomorrow. It'll be interesting. It was kind of funny. Marianne Williamson, who is the spiritual guru who's running and made the debates, and she tweeted out that she's got to hurry up and learn Spanish by tomorrow night, which I thought was kind of funny because it's based in truth. And Andrew Yang said something very similar on Twitter. He'll be on the stage tomorrow. It'll be much more interesting. I think the biggest loser was Beto O'Rourke. He was a doofus again. He has just dried up. He's fizzled. And I won't be surprised if he doesn't make it to Iowa. That is all the time we have for today. We'll be back tomorrow with round two, night two of the opening ceremonies of the Woke Olympics, live from Miami, although I'm not live in Miami. I'm in a basement with cats. But we also have the Christopher Scalia interview, and you get to find out whether or not you won a signed book from Shannon Bream on tomorrow's show. So good luck with that. You can email me, Derek@dailycaller.com. Otherwise, have a great Thursday. Friday is almost upon us.
He sounded to me like sort of an obnoxious guy at a restaurant or a bar talking really loudly on his cell phone.